hope is fading from tourism-dependent islands calling for a timely Pacific bubble. The harsh economic realities of tourists staying away from island holiday spots is really beginning to bite. Not only are border closures keeping international visitors at bay, but imports of vital food and other supplies are also affected. The New Zealand government's position remains that an Australasian bubble would precede a Pacific bubble, and that both would only occur once it is safe. COVID-19 infections are low in the Pacific region compared to many other countries. The Cook Islands, Niue and Tokelau, Samoa and Tonga have remained free of coronavirus. However, not so Fiji, with three new cases in quarantine this week, all repatriations from India. Niue's newly elected Premier, Dalton Tangalangi, supports a Pacific bubble between Niue, Cook Islands, Samoa, Tonga and New Zealand. But as the Australasian bubble now seems further away with the latest lockdown in Melbourne and with more COVID cases here in isolation as New Zealanders return home, a Pacific bubble, it seems, is not imminent. To discuss the economic impact throughout the Pacific region and the weighing up of border openings versus the risk of COVID transmission, we have three guests to talk to this morning. Now, I'd like to welcome first Fiji-based Chris Cocker, Chief Executive of the South Pacific Tourism Organisation. Bulivanaka, welcome, Chris.
Yes, Pacific greetings, Catherine.
Thank you. Could you describe how that beloved destination for so many New Zealanders and Australians as a holiday destination, could you just describe how the islands are coping at the moment with this lack of tourism?
Economically, we are all suffering. As you probably know, Catherine, we're in ground zero at the moment, and this is, of course, unprecedented. It's particularly devastating for the Pacific countries whose GDPs are highly dependent on tourism, such as Fiji, Cook Islands, Tahiti, Vanuatu, and Niue, etc. But according to ADB, it's predicted the GDP for the Pacific region contract by about 0.3%, and economic recovery and growth is not expected until 2021. But now, because things have changed, might be prolonged. The SMEs, which is an estimate about 95% of our regional tourism businesses, are severely impacted. And about 150,000 people who are directly employed in the tourism sector, around 90% of them are unemployed in this case. And New Zealand, AMFED and SPTO released a report around May. And it was done in seven countries, but most of them are large destinations in tourism sector. Over a 12-month period, the impact, financial impact, potential financial impact on these islands is in excess of $3.1 billion. And, of course, this can also increase with the prolonged situation that we are in at the moment.
Goodness, it's just so sobering. And you look at, I think, 90% of Cook Islands' GDP is tourism. As you've intimated, for all the Pacific countries, it's high. For Niue, for Vanuatu, 40% of GDP. Look, what is the flow-on effect, Chris, to people's incomes and well-being? I mean, how are people coping?
Well, you know, the Pacific people are resilient people. And one of the good things that we've seen coming out, particularly from our experience in Fiji, is the tourism sector people, tourism employees who are now unemployed are turning into farming. And, of course, the land is there, etc. So they're moving into farming and growing in this case, because meaning that you don't have to go and purchase your food. The sea is also available as well. So there's a big change in terms of the way people think, etc. They're becoming more innovative. The people are becoming more entrepreneurial. You see more people. There's a setup of markets everywhere in Suva, in Nandi, etc., and people selling stuff in this case. So there is a negative as well as the positive in this case. And I think we are survivors. We've survived cyclones, tsunamis, natural disasters, and we're still here. The thing is, in terms of economic recovery, it will be prolonged and it will affect the wider economy as well as our communities in this case.
What stories of hardship are you hearing specifically from Fiji's resorts and hospitality sector that predominantly caters to visitors? It's wonderful if some of the workers are able to find other ways of supporting themselves. But what about the operators themselves? What are you hearing?
So what Fiji has done is they've probably in the past, just past 2 weeks, they've heavily promoted the Love the Local campaign, and domestic tourism is thriving in this case. Some of the resorts have just lowered their rates for the locals in this case, slash half, even less than half the price. And you see a lot of the locals actually going down to the west and to the down to the north of Fiji in this case. So that's helping some of our tourism operators coming back in terms of getting some of their workers in this case to work back in the industry. The other challenges that they're facing as well, of course, is the financial impact in this case for their operations, how long this will take. A lot of them are now forecasting for best case scenario first quarter 2021 in this case, because of the second wave hitting globally, etc., and also the delays that we've seen with the Trans-Tasman bubble. Realistically, and the best case scenario is first quarter 2021 in this area, and if the worst comes, it'll be the mid-2021. 2020 realistic is written off in terms of any tourist arrivals coming into the region. With Fiji, you see that the private sector operators have been very quite proactive in assisting their staff. They're going out and providing food packages to the unemployed staff. People, like I said, are becoming innovative. There's the Fiji barter system, where people are encouraged to exchange goods, etc., as we have done in the past in the Pacific, and becoming more reliant on home-based micro little enterprises in this case.
That said, you're talking, I think, from the report you cited, tourism earnings of $3 billion, you know, and one wonders how long some of these resorts, a large chunk of that, a third of that is spent on accommodation. One wonders, you know, another half a billion on restaurants and bars. One wonders how long some of the resorts and facilities can sustain this. Are you having any, are most saying, yes, we can hold on to first quarter 2021, or are you worried about some?
The small micro enterprises will struggle, and then definitely there will be some closures, etc. That the larger hotel chains and sort of the medium-based hotel operators, etc., will probably survive to the first quarter. But beyond that, Catherine, I don't know what's going to happen. We're in uncertain times because when COVID-19 hit in March, a lot of the large establishments had forecasted their cash flow to the first quarter of 2021. So in terms of that, a lot of them are quite safe in this case. It's the SMEs that will see a lot of affected impact of some of them closing down, because a lot of them were hoping to meet July this year in terms of their cash flow. But beyond that, you know, we're already in July now. Some of them will struggle.
Chris, what is the view on what was dubbed the Bulla bubble, I think, with respect to Fiji, but more broadly, a travel bubble between a COVID-free New Zealand with all cases in quarantine situations and specific Pacific Islands. We heard again, just confirmed from the Prime Minister's office this morning, that the Australasian Trans-Tasman bubble is to proceed first. What is your view? What are others' views on that? Is there an opportunity being missed here?
I can see the point of view where Australia and New Zealand are coming, but let's be realistic about this bubble and the recent developments of the second wave impacting the globe. And Australia and New Zealand, of course, is their priority to have the Trans-Tasman. I mean, from the region side, would love to have the Pacific bubble, etc., although we are COVID-19 free, most of our islands. But in terms of a bubble, it won't happen for all our Pacific Island countries. We have 20 Pacific member countries. It'll be by, and SPTO stands, it'll be by nation. It's a national decision in this case, and a bilateral agreement between Australia and New Zealand in terms of opening the borders. And I've seen that with a lot of our member countries weighing out the health concerns and economic concerns. The health concerns have come out very strongly because the majority of our Pacific Island countries, although they're COVID-19 free, have not got the facilities, health and safety facilities to protect themselves, and the capability as well as the readiness to open their borders in this case. At the moment, we are starting to see repatriation flights. And without doubt, with the repatriation flights, there will be an import of COVID-19. And you're seeing that in New Zealand. You're seeing that in Fiji in this case. So our member countries need to be ready for that in this case. In terms of the bubble, there will be delays, etc. And I think it's up to New Zealand and Australia to decide what's best for the region in this case, in terms of managing and mitigating the COVID-19. I do sympathize with the countries who are very vulnerable, and of course, Cook Islands and also Tahiti and Fiji are pushing, and of course that's why Fiji has pushed for the Bula bubble in this case. With the rest of the other countries, there needs to be proper review and also ensuring that their health systems are in place in this case. And in the report that we released with the New Zealand AMFED, there are key factors that needs to happen or be in place for any reactivation of the tourism sector in the region. First and foremost on that report was the health systems of our countries. It must be in place. Then there must be clear policy borders on reopening of our borders in this case, and then other factors come through after that.
Thank you, Chris. Stay with us, please. Chris Cocker is Chief Executive of the South Pacific Tourism Organisation. We welcome two further guests now. If I can welcome the Chief Executive of the Cook Islands Tourism Marketing Corporation, Halatoa Fua. Kia Orana, and welcome to 9 to Noon.
Kia Orana, and thank you for the opportunity, Halatoa here.
May I also welcome from the Niue Tourism Board, Doreen Siatanga. Welcome, whakalofa atu, Doreen.
Whakalofa atu.
Doreen, can I start with
Catherine?
You? Yes, thank you. Can I start with you, Doreen, please? The as we heard in the introduction, Niue's newly elected Premier, Dalton Tangalangi, supports a Pacific bubble between Niue, Cook Islands, Samoa, Tonga and New Zealand. The argument for that being they are countries that are essentially COVID-free, albeit with isolated cases at the border. What's the rationale, Doreen?
I think the rationale is because of the economic implications that we're having right now, because we're a very small economy. And we are seeing the impacts that COVID-19 has on the island, especially the tourism sector, because tourism is our main economic driver. And we have now seen the effects that's happening, and most probably why the Premier wants to get into this bubble, but at the moment there are risks around it as well, because we are very small, and also our small health system as well that we have to consider in that rationale.
Very small population on Niue compared to New Zealand. However, the New Zealand tourist market has become very significant recently as a popular holiday destination package. And just how are the tourism operators coping now that that's not there?
At the moment, I think I can say that tourism is dead in the water, especially for Niue, because we are not getting any. We only have one flight a week now, and we only have passenger flights in every 2 weeks. And we have limited the numbers to only 26. That's because that's what our health system can cater right now.
How many businesses on Niue are tourism-based and therefore having to cope with the situation?
At the moment, I can't really say how many in the, I mean, that, but there are tourism-related businesses and also accommodation providers, which are the primary ones. So I can't really say how many at the moment, but there's quite a few tourism operators. But there also we have fishing charters that especially depending on tourists as well for their business.
I've seen a figure of 60% overall, if you include all those, something like 60%. Does that sound about right? It sounds very significant.
Yes, that would be about right.
So what assistance is being given to those who are without the income at the moment?
At the moment, we have a wage subsidy that we give out to those operators, especially for the workers and the owners as well. But we, at the moment, we don't know how long that will go on for. That wage subsidy assistance that the government is giving out to the private sector. And that is the only form of assistance that we have been giving out. But also, we try, the economic activity has to be local as well. And for the government, we have to sort of like keep sort of paying people so that there's a minimum level of economic activities happening locally, because at the moment we're not getting any economic activity from outside of the country.
Doreen, I hear from you, as I did from Chris, the obvious corollary to opening the borders, even between countries that have technically eliminated, which is that the health facilities, there needs to be greater confidence in the health facilities to deal with even an isolated outbreak. And are those conversations happening with New Zealand? Does it need to be more than just saying everyone looks like they're COVID-free at the moment? Does there need to be a backup?
I think, yeah, the conversation has been going on, but also we are guided by New Zealand and our controls occur abroad before people get into Niue. So all the testing, all the exit screening has to be happening abroad before the people get here to Niue.
So you would have to have confidence, absolute confidence in the rigour of New Zealand's testing before people are allowed to leave the country and come to Niue or to any of the islands.
Yes.
And that includes
that
if they
yeah.
And that includes also, and this is one of the complications with the Australian travel bubble, if we did it state by state, how would you reassure yourself that someone hadn't travelled interstate or hadn't come in from another country? There would have to be a very rigorous system to ensure no one headed for the islands who could possibly be carrying COVID.
Yes, that would be the case at this point in time.
Financially,
we have to trust New Zealand with their mechanisms and whatever they have in place.
Doreen,
that would be key to us.
Yes. How long can the government continue financially supporting people with their income down this much?
At the moment, it's hard to say because we don't know how long this is going on for, and we don't know whether we're going to get any assistance from outside as well to cope with the sort of situation as well. So at the moment, because our revenues have hit quite hard as well, and we've been seeing like dropped in government revenues, that we won't be able to assist in the long term.
Doreen, thank you. Please stay with us too. Mrs. Doreen Seatanga, Niue Tourism Board Member. And as we introduced just a short time ago, Halatoa Fua, Chief Executive of the Cook Islands Tourism Marketing Corporation. Halatoa looks such a beloved destination with Australians and New Zealanders, the Cook Islands. In fact, I think I saw from those figures earlier from Chris that something like 90% of the Cook Islands GDP comes from tourism. Just how much is this hurting, Halatoa?
Thank you, Glenda, for the opportunity. So we've all been confronted with this pandemic, and it's created a lot of havoc around the world. When you look at the situation of the Cook Islands, the early border restrictions that was placed in March was at the right time, as we managed to respond from a health perspective to protect the population here in the Cook Islands, that it's a vulnerable population as well. The time that we reach at this point is that we've reached a crossroad where the economic impact has far outweighs the risk of spreading the virus here. And part of that has got to do with how New Zealand has successfully managed COVID-19 in New Zealand. And the cases that you're getting are all imported cases that are controlled in a quarantine space. And so the economic impact in the Cook Islands is now felt by the community. Just confirmed yesterday that our wage subsidy that we've offered, it has been extended to the end of September, is about 3,000 people on the wage subsidy, which is a significant portion of our workforce, particularly around tourism and hospitality. And so the need to start expediting some sort of economic relief for the country is important for us. Just to give an example, in the last 3 months, it is a shoulder period for us here in the Cook Islands. So it's not our peak period. Our peak period of travel is between July and September, as influenced by the New Zealand winter. But in the last 3 months, the economic loss from tourism has reached about 107 million, which is now felt across the country. And as a tourism dependent economy, it'll have a significant bearing on livelihoods and impact on households. And so the need to elevate those discussions with the border reopening is important for us, because we believe there is a need for Kiwis that are still wanting to come on holidays. There's a robust process that the Ministry of Health, in collaboration with the Ministry of Health in New Zealand, are looking at. We're talking quite extensively with the Auckland Airport, as well as the key airlines, to formalise a process that is conducive to the situation we're in now, as well as the work that we're doing here in tourism to prepare the industry through rapid training of physical distancing measures, disinfection, as well as good hygiene measures. There is a collective approach that we're all working as key stakeholders to prepare for such time that we open the border.
Halatoa, I can hear everything that's happening then to get ready to go.
Yep.
Do you believe at the Cook Islands end you are ready to go, with New Zealand anyway?
Yes, there has been a lot of planning behind the scenes. Our Ministry of Health have an easing of border restrictions plan that they are implementing. There has been a significant amount of investment that has been poured into the health system here through a negative pressurized room. We've looked at a whole ward that can cater for any such related cases to COVID. PPE gear has been top of priority of the list, and the population here has been tested at about 17% of the population, and majority of these tests have been New Zealand lab tested. Anyway, we've implemented a Cook Safe QR codes initiative that can, as a complementary contact tracing mechanism to the manual system they already have. We live in small communities, and so contact tracing can be easily mobilized here manually, but we've also implemented the QR codes, given it's technologically allows us to do that work as well.
Halatoa, we've had terrible precedents, and far too recently, in the havoc that can be wreaked, the tragedy that can come from a rapidly spreading, uncontrolled infection. And how much is that on people's minds, no matter how much effort goes into this?
Yes, I think that we acknowledge that is at the top of people's minds, that we have to be vigilant. The change, the paradigm shift here in the Cook Islands when the borders closed was very drastic. People became completely vigilant in everything that we did, social distancing measures, physical distancing. you go to the supermarkets here, that was practiced, even though we had no confirmed cases here. So the community had become adaptable to this whole agile environment that we're in. And so the communication plan and strategy that has been implemented by the Ministry of Health has worked in penetrating that message to the community. And if you look at the outer islands outside of Rarotonga, they're in a more vulnerable state, and it's much smaller communities with more fragile health systems. So that's something that the Cook Islands have learnt to adapt quickly into that space. And with the border opening, it also heightens our preparations to ensure that we continue to be vigilant. There's going to be greater awareness campaigns in how we prepare the population, and especially with the vulnerable groups of people that we have here.
Halatoa, what do you believe the hold-up is then? Is it going to be political and diplomatic in the end, that Australia or the Australian states come first, which seems to be the New Zealand government's position, even if that's not necessarily the logic? Is that the reality?
Well, I think it's more of a question to New Zealand. It seems to be that could be the reality. We will do everything on our part to highlight to New Zealand the situation that we're in and the measures that we could put in place to allow leisure travel for Kiwis that can come here. I think that there is a complete safetiness in the process that we are wanting to implement collectively to ensure that the protection of the population here is at the forefront of our minds, and mobilizing that through our key partners, whether you're in the airlines, Auckland Airport, as well as domestically here, we believe that we can implement this quite quickly, up and running as soon as we can, to have a travel bubble between New Zealand and the Cook Islands without necessarily waiting for the Trans-Tasman opening, because there's a lot of uncertainty that we are facing at this stage. And initially, the Trans-Tasman bubble was going to be activated earlier than we thought. And as we can see from Australian counterparts, that's not the case. So there's a lot of uncertainty there. And also, you would have read about the surge in cases in Victoria. So the other point that I would like to make, Lander, is that the economic gain from Australians coming to New Zealand is clear. And, you know, as the largest market, source market to the New Zealand tourism industry, we all understand that. And that, you know, sometimes the Cook Islands can be perceived as a net economic drain to New Zealand, but it's actually not. It's the net economic gain that we provide to New Zealand through importation of goods and services, whether it's from the imports that we recorded in 2018 is about $180 million that went back to New Zealand for imports, as well as the cost that we pay for airfares. So airfares in New Zealand, for example, is over $200 million that we return back. Sure. In airfare purchases. So there's a net economic gain that we can justify the job creation that's being done in New Zealand to justify such opening of border and value add that the Cook Islands can provide.
Thank you again. Halatoa Fua of the Cook Islands Tourism Marketing Corporation. Thanks very much also to our guests earlier, Doreen Siatanga of the Niue Tourism Board and Chris Cocker, Chief Executive of the South Pacific Tourism Organisation.